Tonight, Australia begins its T20 World Cup campaign with the first of two warm-up games, New Zealand and India, over the next couple of days. The tournament opener for Australia is on Saturday night. What to expect? What to expect at a tournament where Australia hasn't produced anything of substance just yet? The pinnacle of the summer is the Ashes. Matters are still unsettled within Australian cricket. The chairman got rolled last week. The coach is under immense scrutiny. There are obvious gaps in the team as well as its lines of strength. There is a great deal on the line, particularly with the conversation now running as to whether this generation of Australian men have underachieved. So let's set the cricket landscape for our conversations that will run right through the summer. Robert Craddock, Crash, hello.
G'day, Jared. It's, just listening to you there, you can feel the temperature rising. It's great. I love it. I love an Ashes summer. There's nothing quite like it.
How much is at stake, do you reckon, this summer?
Oh, huge. Like, right from next weekend. I mean, Justin Langer can't afford for Australia to just vanish without trace in this T20 World Cup. It won't cost him his job, but it just shapes the narrative for the summer, doesn't it? Langer under more pressure for the Ashes. They need a dignified finish in this tournament. T20, they've never played it well. I've often feel that, Jared, we've failed to snatch the nuances of T20 with our selection. We just get our best batsmen and shoehorn them into the team. We don't accept that. Hang on, who's the best finisher? He mightn't have the averages, he mightn't have the profile, but he can slog a ball from Hobart to Launceston when the going gets hot. So, you know, it's a game of nuance, and I don't think Australia's ever really caught up with that at international level.
And it doesn't necessarily make sense, Crash, does it? Because there is so much T20 IP within Australian cricket, which is sought after around the world. There are individuals who have been successful in the IPL and in the Caribbean. We laud the BBL for what it is here. So it's not like there's a lack of attempt to practice at it. And yet we've never been able to convey that, to parlay that into powerhouse international performances.
Yeah, and it's never meant that much to Australia and the international T20s. And that's why we're happy to pick a guy who's bats at the top of the order in the Big Bash and throw him in the middle of the order in T20s, which is a completely different role. So, look, they're going to have to be a bit funky to be in this tournament, Jared. And the stakes are high, as was pointed out this morning. Andrew Wu said, and it's a good point, that for next year's T20 World Cup in Australia, the top six qualify in world rankings, and then the finalists for this tournament. Well, at the moment, Australia ranks seven. So wouldn't that be a sight? Australia having to fight its way past Oman and Papua New Guinea, Scotland, next in hosting its own World T20. That would quite be something, wouldn't it?
It would be undignified is what it would be. You used the word dignified there. Australia needs a dignified finish. So this is a sudden death tournament. You can't misstep virtually at all, given that it goes straight from pools to semis. What constitutes an acceptable performance, do you think, for Australia in the UAE and Dubai, where I saw a statistic which I'll delve further into as the week goes along. Australia has the slowest run rate in T20 cricket in that part of the world of all teams at the tournament.
Yeah, semi-final finish, I'd say, would be a minor pass mark and probably keep the Wolves at bay for Langer for a little while. But it's also it's how they finish too. If it's a two-run loss compared to a catastrophic batting collapse. But you're right. And it just comes down to, in that part of the world, Australia just doesn't play spin well. And that's the big thing. We have no real spinning wickets in Australia. We don't think ahead. I mean, we've got three test tours of the subcontinent coming up in 18 months, which to me is enough to say to the SCG groundsman, I want a Bunsen burner for all Sheffield Shield games over the next couple of years, thanks. You'll get complaints. I don't care. Shave it. We need a spinning wicket in Australia. Now, I know COVID has cast a shadow over everything, but why not think that way? I mean, we used Jukes balls in the Sheffield Shield to protect to help us prepare for the Ashes, and it worked. Australia drew the Ashes series in England with Jukes balls. Nice project. But where's the spinning deck that gets us ready to play in the subcontinent? It's invisible.
So the T20 questions that have to be answered across the two warm-up games, so it's New Zealand and India. It's 1 a.m. tomorrow. It's there on Fox Cricket. And then it's, I think it's 9 o'clock Wednesday night. So we get a good look. Finch hasn't played much cricket. He's had the knee surgery. He wasn't selected in the IPL. Warner lost his place in his IPL team, both at the first incarnation of this year's tournament and at its conclusion. Smith has not set the world on fire. Mitch Marsh wants his place at three. Stark and Cummins are the frontline attack, and you'd only take two quicks, evidently, on these pitches. And yet Hazelwood's just come out of the IPL champion team, where he's played a key strangling role, as it was described. So there are some... Australia is not a set 11 for Saturday night and for the duration of the tournament, which is an interesting position to be in so close to it.
Yeah, and Hazelwood's the one that really interests me because, of course, he missed the last 50-over World Cup. It bowled, you know, fine in the IPL and just is so reliable. Big match player, nice temperament, but you can't squeeze him in. I mean, I still like the idea of, as well as playing Zampa, playing Mitchell Swepson as well, because, Jared, you know one performance I've never forgot in White Ball World Cups? The way that Brad Hogg breezed through two beautiful undefeated World Cups for Australia as a sort of a hit-and-run merchant, where because you only see him once, it's hard to pick their varieties. And I think Swepson, who bowls quite a nice wrong and a little flipper, they're great. If you can beat both sides of the bat, you sort of strike before that. You can almost see their squinty eyes saying, what's this bloke doing? And then he's gone. He's bowled four overs and taken two for 22. And so I still believe that they should consider that. I'm not sure they're brave enough for it, but I hope they do.
So these aren't the conditions where Australia is likely to thrive, but in a year's time, Australia hosts the next edition of the T20 World Cup, the delayed from last year. So the ramifications of this performance, I think, are really interesting. Australian cricket will tolerate whatever happens, barring an unmitigated disaster. But the women have already won this tournament at home, and there'll be a burning expectation that the men are able to do the same. So I think it's almost what happens institutionally after this. Will the T20 program be separated out? Will the whole white ball program be separated out? Some of this is linked to Langer's tenure, and some of it is just a philosophical decision that Australia has been slow to make, but it now has. And you wrote the story today that George Bailey's been joined by Tony Dottamade on the selection panel with Langer as the coach. Do you think the future of Australia's T20 program is actually at stake now?
Yeah, I do, because if you're going to take it seriously, I mean, Darren Lehman said it all along. He said there should be one of the fallouts from his era. He said it's just too much for one guy to coach all three formats for Australia. It should be split up. And Australia has the coaches to do it. Like, if you put Andrew McDonald in charge of the test team, you could bring in Trevor Bayliss as your white ball man, like he was for England. And he took him to World Cup glory by prioritising that form of the game. And what I especially like about that sort of move, Jared, is that Bayliss has been there and done it as a coach. He's not trying to impress anybody. He's not auditioning for anything. He can actually be a mentor for McDonald along the way. He can say, mate, you do the test team. I'll do the white ball stuff. But let me be your bouncing board. Let me help you where I can. And it's just a nice fit. I haven't seen anything that in the last few months to convince me of anything else that should be, you know, Australia's next fit post-Langer.
So the precursor's the T20 World Cup, and then the pinnacle's the Ashes. Greg Baum wrote the piece on the weekend, didn't he? It's a long road in to the Ashes, Crash, being December. Sometimes we start on Oaks Day and get to it nice and quickly. The sparring has begun, and they've got a long time to throw haymakers at each other.
Yeah. Oh, I must say, I do love the banter in Ashes, though. The English press corps are fabulous company, and about 12 of them have got accreditation. They're coming out. John Etheridge from The Sun, you know, and a lot of them are really learned guys. They play the game. You know, like the Sun loves these fancy headlines and fruity stories, but a lot of times their journalists are the most educated and sort of articulate and clever of a lot of us. So to me, and I love Bormie's piece too, but it's the Ashes is all about that, you know, and it all starts, you know. I was always entranced by that line from Bruce Wilson once, the former overseas correspondent, when he said that England have sent an SOS to Prince Charles to save their batting. And Charles wrote back and said, "I can't bat, but Camilla Parker bowls." You know, and it, like, it's got the all those little threads from the humorous to the ridiculous, and good fun all the way.
Where should we set our expectations for the Ashes, Crash?
It's just non-negotiable. I mean, imagine if Australia lost this series at home, the Ashes. They've lost two series out of the last two series to India in Australia. And it's a non-negotiable that Australia wins the Ashes at home. And I think they will, because England, I just see 6 out of 10 with everything. A bowling attack that's 6 out of 10. You know, and they say, "Oh, we're just going to bowl straight and pack the leg side like India did." Well, you've got to be good with that one. You stray a little bit last session or anything like that and you're gone, you know. But, you know, you think of that first test in Brisbane, Jared. Like, Australia hasn't played red ball cricket, a lot of their team, basically since the last Brisbane test. They're coming out of quarantine. England will be here with a couple of ropey practice matches played in hard quarantine. But they have played 18 tests in COVID to Australia's 4. So that's their big chance. They have to jump Australia at the Gabba. There has to be a final press conference at the Gabba with Tim Payne saying, "Gee, we were rusty. I didn't realise how rusty we were." That's their chance, England. They've got to be up and about. For 35 years, Jared, I've seen teams drift through Brisbane at the start of the tour. There's no Operation Gabba. There's no sort of "let's get in here early." There's no sort of, you know, "let's really assimilate and think about the conditions with our team and everything." India, they cracked the curse last season, didn't they? The first victors here in 33 years. And they did. It was the end of the tour with a bunch of lads who were so unpretentious and just wallowing in the thought of getting a chance in Test cricket. They never thought they'd have. They were brilliant. But that apart, gee, there's been some. So England have to have Mission Gabba. Let's storm the fortress again.
I know there is a temptation to measure it all through England, which I do get. But Crash, from an Australian perspective, things are unsettled. It feels like the approach to the coaching position is, "Well, let's cross our fingers and hope England are no good." And the chairman just got rolled. Is Australian cricket is not poised? Is that idea of they may have underachieved through this period of time, there is merit to that, but there's also rationale to that. It's not like suddenly Australian cricket's got absolutely everything in order to assert a level of dominance.
Totally fair point. I mean, look, have a look at it. I mean, the big series lost to South Africa at home and away. India, two losses at home and endless losses away. And, you know, in the big series, Australia's just not putting trophies in the cabinet. We're just average, you know, for a nation. I mean, this is Australia. We've got high expectations. We ruled the world, you know. We've got the best system, the best coaching facility, the best coaches, you know, and we're number 7 in T20 cricket. How does that work? You know, so Australia is marked hard. It should be marked hard, and it should expect so much of itself. But it needs leaders, Jared, on and off the park, and right now it hasn't got many, to be honest with you. In administration, you know, you can say what you like about Peter Volandis and rugby league, but he's a natural leader and he drags the sport with him for better and occasionally for worse, but generally for better. I don't see that in cricket in the big moments. I don't see leaders saying, you know, "we're taking our sport forward." You know, it's all done very quite timidly, to be honest, Jared.
Is the appointment of a new chairman a really important moment?
Oh, it is, because I think they need a figurehead, someone prepared to get out there and put his face in front of cameras and talk, you know. That's what Volandis does. I mean, you know, when the COVID crisis was gripping, he put aside an hour every night and he'd be on the phone to 6 different journos who were trying to get him. You know, he was eminently contactable, you know. And I think cricket needs that figurehead, you know. It's just, they're hard to find. But Mark Taylor, I was so disappointed he left the board. I can understand why he did, but he was that sort of guy. He was a voice of reason in the boardroom, and he was a voice of reason on the cricket field and in front of the cameras. He could have done that role. I would have loved to have seen them maybe even think about getting him back for that role. Maybe there's too much water passed under the bridge, but there's not many people can do it. But you know, someone's got to be confident enough to speak up for cricket.
We set the cricket landscape for the months ahead with Robert Craddock, with Australia opening the warm-up games for its T20 World Cup tournament tonight. We'll take your calls with Crash now, right throughout. Mick and Phil are about to join us. Robert Craddock on a Monday with ever-increasing importance. He's been moved up the order with cricket taking focus.
You know, we haven't had the same team on board for the last, what was it, probably 2 years. You know, it's been different guys resting here and there, and with the schedule the way it is, it's so full on. To have this team now together for a World Cup, you know, the ranking says one thing, but I think you look around the group and it says another.
That's Josh Hazlewood, who was part of the IPL champion-winning team, and a few of you are just insistent that he must be part of Australia's campaign here. Hazlewood must play if Aussies are any chance. Hazlewood is the best and most consistent bowler we have in any form. Robert Craddock, this is part of now what happens with the international season beginning. The national selection meeting has begun with all 25 million of us, but there's the third banana has been picked.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'll be interested to see, because they naturally cannot fit three bowlers into that team. For me, it's Hazlewood or Cummins or Stark, but he may not play in the first game, Josh Hazlewood, but I can see him being pitchforked in because he's the one guy who's had match practice in those conditions. So, look, it's a big decision, Jared, isn't it? You know, you've got to play Zampa, and probably Agar will be in there as well. So, but I don't reckon he may start on the outer, but he'll come surging into contention.
Mick's with us in Brisbane. Welcome to you, Mick.
Hey, Jared. G'day, Crash.
Hey, Mick.
Yeah, Crash, quick one for you on the wicket-keeping situation in Australia. Like, we know Tim Payne's closer to the end than the start, and it looks like Carey's, you know, a couple of lengths clear, 100 metres to go to get the next test gig. But I look at this bloke up here, Pearce, and he hadn't done a lot wrong in his last 10 or a dozen Shield games. And there's a bloke over in West Australia, Inglis, that's going all right too. Do they want, are they resigned, are they set on Carey, do you think, for to be the next sort of Brad Haddin to Adam Gilchrist, you know, et cetera? Or is it still a little bit open? I see last night on Twitter, Darren Berry, who he's a proud Vic, he's very objective and he sort of likes Pearson. And then Greg Blewett chimed in and said, you can't say that, Carey. And then Tom Moody come in with Inglis. It felt like the state premiers were all advocating for who's done the best job in the coronavirus, you know.
But yes, Mick, you know what? I saw that last night on Twitter and it really interests me because Darren Berry is a fabulous judge of a keeper. And the instant he did it, Greg Blewett chimed in. I think he said something like, so is you rate him ahead of Carey, you rate Pearson ahead of Carey as a batsman and a keeper, do you? And it was nice spirited stuff. And it was significant for Pearson because at age 29, he has forced his way into the equation by, he could score another century, his second in 2 weeks today. The best thing he ever did was a couple of years ago when COVID started, he paid $5,000 to get a ball machine shipped up from Melbourne. And it was the best 5K he's ever spent because he just faced session after session and became a two lengths better batsman. It was terrific. So he's in there. Carey, for mine, is still ahead. And you must remember this, Mick. When they replace Payne, probably Langer goes as well. So you've got the captain going and the coach going. So that senior professional status that Carey has will help him. You know, he's got a good temperament. It'll be heavy duty for that keeper, I tell you. Australia's got three tours of the subcontinent in the next 18 months, which is a lot of keeping over the stumps. So it's a big call. We've seen shock calls for keeper before. Ian Healy, Payne himself. If Pearson got it, he's coming from nowhere near as far back as Payne did, who at one stage wasn't even keeping for Tasmania, and he became Australian captain. So I've got Carey in front, but Inglis is a man of interest, particularly in white ball cricket, and Pearson is the smoky. It's a very, Jared, interesting call, isn't it?
It is. It's one for post the Ashes, but yeah, it did. It certainly lit up. I know John's going to set us up for the Ashes summer ahead. John, welcome.
G'day, Crash. G'day, Jared. Welcome back. And Crash, I have called you in years gone by, but there hasn't been much comment about the extent of the challenge to Joe Root as captain, as there has about his test record in Ashes tests here, which, of course, doesn't include a test century yet. And I just did some homework on all of that. So although England's last win here, as you know, was only two series ago, if Root is to win the Ashes this series, he will be only the 13th captain, England captain ever, the second this century, that is including Strauss, and the sixth since World War II. And so far, his record overseas is not that good. He's only won two overseas without Stokes, for instance, and that was in Sri Lanka, out of the 10 that he's won as captain. But I was amazed. So really, there are two records that I think he's likely to break in Australia this year. One he'll look forward to, and the other he won't. Do you have any idea what the one he'll look forward to is?
I'm just trying to think. No, I think you've got me, John. What is it? You tell us.
The longest captaincy so far is Alistair Cook, 59. Which is different to us. You see, the board has 93 captaincies, and so we've got a lot of... Australia's only ever had 47 Australian captains, as you know, and England have had 81, so that's not surprising. Alistair Cook, 59. So Root strides out of the MCG and becomes the longest-serving England captain ever. So he'd be looking forward to that one. The one he won't be looking forward to, and Michael Vaughan gave us a bit of a hint on this, is if they were to lose 5-0... he will not only be the only captain, England captain ever to captain two series and lose them both, but he will be the only England captain ever not to win a single test match in Australia because he was in the drawn one in his last series, as you remember, saved by Alistair Cook's 240-odd. So I think both of those records, certainly the second one with Vaughan helping us along that line of thinking, and he will be the only England captain ever not to have played in a winning test, not to have played it ever a winning test match in Australia. So there you go. It's quite a challenge for him, which we're not hearing much about, particularly without Stokes, of course.
No, look, good points, John. When I think of Joe Root as a captain, I remember where it all started. And when he was chosen, I still remember Graham Swann saying, oh, Joe Root is captain. He said he was the back of the bus boy. He said the kid with the cheeky smile, the kid born to have fun. And he said, I hope he never loses that. And you see the change in Joe. Like, he's necessarily become more somber and sober, hasn't it? The captaincy gets guys like that. But he has become a really important sort of custodian of the game's traditions. He's a good man, Joe Root. I've never heard anyone say anything else than that. So good on him. But England have won 6 out of their last 42 tests in Australia. They just don't get hot here. So it's a big challenge. And I know it burred Joe up when Michael Vaughan said, OK, I know he's winning all this stuff at home. He has to win in Australia before we can call him a great captain. Joe burred up over it, but it's totally fair point. It will be a defining moment of his captaincy. He needs to win an Ashes series.
You can match wits with Crash right throughout this cricket season on a Monday. Phil's in Sunbury. Welcome to you, Phil.
Yeah, good day. Welcome back. Bit concerned about Will Pekoski. My harshest opinion is he should retire. Sad to say that, but I think it also means that Victorian cricket is letting down. We reward mediocrity, and his reflexes were okay for junior cricket, but because junior cricket is so junior nowadays, it's not much better in district cricket because we don't have any senior players playing district cricket anymore. And I think this all goes back that the last group of really well-coached cricketers we had goes back as far, even before Ponting, to, say, Mark Waugh. Now, Mark Waugh had to make century after century. It's called Afghanistan, but we've got the war for a long time. But he had to develop his game, and he had to develop it amongst senior cricketers. So I have to say, I think Will Pekoski, unless he can get something done in the lines of Angus Brayshaw, we have to forget him and concentrate on someone else.
Yeah, well,
such a hard figure to forget, given that he looks like the player of the generation, Phil. But, Crash, there's the narrow and then there's the broad there. And I think there are no minor concussions when you've had repeated concussions like Will has had.
Yeah, and look, 10 concussions by the age of 23. I mean, that is really significant in a non-contact sport. You've got to keep saying that. It's not rugby league. And I don't think it's a reflex thing, Phil. I disagree, because I think other players get hit on the head, but it doesn't give them concussion, so you never hear about it. Like, whereas if Pekoski gets hit on the head in the nets, there's generally major repercussions. This is an interesting one, because there's two different narratives here. Tim Payne said he was really concerned about Pekoski and the future and the season, whereas in the Victorian setup, they're saying, oh, no, he could be okay for the first Shield game. I sense the truth is somewhere in between. The thought of throwing him in to open the batting in an Ashes test with this ahead of him, hanging over him, is a major call. I mean, he's got a beautiful game, a 360-degree scoring angles, a nice, mature attitude. You hear him talk on your show, Jared, you swear he's 33. You know, he's got that sort of wisdom about him. But it is a big call. I would be reluctant to open the batting with him if he plays, feeling that maybe Usman Khawaja opening the batting and Pekoski down the order would be a better solution. But just the thought of him and of facing that hard ball first up, I don't know whether it's the right decision for Australia at the moment.
Malcolm's with us in Adelaide. Welcome, Malcolm.
G'day, boys. First off, I think Alex Carey is the real victim of sandpaper gate. He should have been to the side long ago. But, Crash, on Travis Head, I think a South Australian, we've always, you rate Travis's ability, but he'd be intensely frustrated where he seemingly wasn't, improving on his errors. Like the classic was the test match in Perth with getting caught at third man in both innings. But ironically, it was a district game towards the end of last year where he batted through, made 100, not out, when Tester Gully won the game, where I felt, geez, he's finally learning, going through the experience where previously in a district game, Travis would have come in and smashed 50-odd off 40-odd balls and got out, where he actually bothered to bat the whole day and get Tester Gully home. And, he's free scoring this year. He's been batting on Karen Ralton Highway. But I just reckon he's finally getting it. I think he's ready to show everyone his undoubted ability on the international scene of more prominence and consistency.
Yes, Malcolm, I'll tell you a few little sneaky theories, mate, that I've heard about Travis. One is that a little birdie told me that Justin Langer actually did some very good coaching with him, and they tinkered with his technique to sort of get his hands and bat out of the road of his pad and more around more and open him up a little bit more, and that's made a whole lot of difference. And the second one is, I know they like him, but they felt this, that in the South Australian system over the past few years, things had become so dire that he wasn't really getting the tough love that he needed. And remember, the last time I spoke to Dean Jones, he said, quite provocatively, he said, I would move Head out of Adelaide and into that viper's den in Sydney where nothing's given to you and you've got to scrape and claw your way through and no one rates you. Yeah. He said, it toughens you up. He said, in South Australia, he felt we were breeding these lovely guys who just weren't succeeding. And he was fearful that Travis Head would join three other left-handers, Darren Lehman, Wayne Phillips and David Hooks, as being obscene, really talented, but not really getting there to deliver what they would. But I've got great faith in Jason Gillespie as the Redbacks coach. He's a smart, guy, and it's already there's signs that he's sort of moving this team after a difficult year last year. But they haven't lost interest in Travis Head. They have not. I mean, he was in vice captain. They like him. But I get the narrative too. They're trying to give him challenges, the national selectors. Just cruel to be kind. Acorn on his seat stuff. I quite like it, actually. And he is improving, no question.
Yeah. Travis Head and Usman Khawaja. So these selection calls, we've got plenty of time to mull over and a lot of form to contemplate, but I'm not going to let it slide. That you, so you've popped Khawaja back in the opening position?
Oh, I think at the moment he's about even money you're getting in. Like it was a lovely century on a difficult, difficult wicket against South Australia yesterday. They don't love Khawaja. And Jared, I'm really interested to see how he would mend back in the team after him saying that his teammates backstabbed Justin Langer. He was quite open about it. And it wasn't an accidental quote. He put it on his YouTube video. And I spoke to him at training about it, and he was quite comfortable about it because he stabbed Langer in the front, if you know what I mean. And I'm being a little bit decorative with my language there, but he looked Langer in the eye. Remember the Ashes video in 2019 and said, guys are on eggshells around you, Justin, you know? And they ended up having quite a good relationship because that's Khawaja's style. He's up front and he looks guys in the eye. You know, I've copped it as a journalist from him. He rings up and said, hey, mate, where are you getting up with that story? And that's fine. You can deal with people like that. And I think Langer grew to appreciate Khawaja's honesty because, you know, he can be, but he's got a few things to overcome too. He's fallen out of favour. He didn't get a contract, but his record in Australia is good. And opening the batting average is better than 90, I think, in tests. So there you are.
Crash, it's great to chat. I can't wait for these weeks as we work our way through the T20 World Cup and then off towards the Ashes.
Thanks, Jared. And my favourite moment of the weekend, in a quirky sort of way, was hearing Grace Harris, from the Brisbane Heat, commentate on herself when she had the mic on, saying, oh, that's too short. Took us back to a West Indian called Carlisle Best, who used to go into radio commentary while he batted St. Carlisle facing up. And when he hit a four, he'd say, you don't bowl there to Carlisle Best. And then when he got out, he'd walk off and saying, oh, Carlisle was too early on that one. He won't be happy with himself, will Carlisle Best? I looked him up this morning because he took back and I thought, everyone used to, only played seven tests, but everyone loved Carlisle, including Carlisle.
third person congratulator of the year, Crash. Brilliant. You're in great form. Very much worthy of the promotion up the order. 10 o'clock on Mondays from here. Good on you.
Thanks, Jared. See you next week. Bye.
The wisdom and experience of Robert Craddock.